ran away into the crowd. Philip thought, I could really begin to hate her. Britt the Younger said, God, I hate her. Martin worked his way through the crowd. He didn't want to admit to himself that he was looking for Gwen. He was so focused on scanning the distant corners of the room that he nearly ran directly into the two hostile men in top hats.
Oh, hey, Martin said brightly. I was hoping I'd bump into you.
Oh, were you?
Said the top-hatted man on the left. He was stocky, tall, and angry-looking. His mustache was straight, waxed, and angry-looking. Martin suspected that this effect had to do with the angle at which the two halves of his mustache met under his nose. His name tag said Gilbert, that he originally came from 2007, and that he currently resided in the year 1906.
Yes, Martin said. I noticed you eyeballing me and my friend earlier. I figured the civilized thing to do would be to come over, introduce myself.
The second top-hatted man, taller, with a thoroughly oiled Van Dyke, a monocle and a name tag that said Sid, interrupted Martin, saying,
You're Martin Banks, also known as Martin the Magnificent, the Great Martini, and that git who hangs around with Philip.
Ah, we've met, Martin said. I assume we meet in the future?
Correct,
said Gilbert. So, Martin said, determined to figure these two guys out.
You're magicians.
Sid said,
Yep.
And you do magic?
Yes, we are magicians. We do magic.
Gilbert explained slowly.
Well, obviously, Martin said.
You're the one who asked,
Sid replied. Martin said, What I mean is, you two are like us. You can do real magic, as far as your audience is concerned.
Yes.
Sid agreed.
But when you do magic, do you do magic? I mean, when you do your magic act, do you do fake magic tricks, or do you, you know, do real magic?
Sid pinched the bridge of his nose and shook his head. Gilbert was aghast.
Are you suggesting that we would advertise ourselves as magicians, then get up on stage and do magic?
I was just asking, Martin said.
We would never dream of such a thing,
Gilbert sputtered. Why not?
It would be dishonest, that's why. Or does that not matter to you?
Martin said, You're telling your audience that you're going to do magic. Why would it be dishonest to go ahead and do magic? Sid said,
Because, mate, the audience expects us to fool them. They don't think a magician can really do magic. They come to be entertained by a lie. We can't get up there and show them something that's not a lie. We'd have lured them in under false pretenses. Can't you understand that?
Martin's mouth said that he could, but his face said that he couldn't.
When people walk out of a magic show, Gilbert explained, they say, I wonder how he did that. They picture lots of mirrors and trap doors, strings that are too fine to see, that sort of thing. Imagine how unsatisfying it would be if they found out the answer was, he did it with magic. They'd be terribly disappointed.
So you have magic powers, but your act is made up of normal magician's tricks.
Yes, it's the only honest way to proceed.
Do you invent the tricks yourselves?
No, we go to the future and copy them from modern magicians.
Martin said, So you're thieves.
Sid smiled and said,
That's what you say later, when you find out what we are doing for the first time.
Martin said,
Well, it's good to know I agree with me.
Gwen had never been much for parties. Her usual plan was to find the quietest part of the room, go there, and try not to make it any louder. She had spent most of the evening getting caught in, then escaping from, conversations with men she'd never met and knew nothing about. It would have been nice if she could have latched on to either Philip or Martin and spent the evening teamed up with one of them. But Britt the Elder had specifically asked her to leave Philip to his own devices for the evening. And Martin was acting strange, which sadly for Martin, wasn't all that strange. Along the wall, where Gwen could easily reach it, there was a door that led to a balcony. She might be able to get away from the crowd for a few minutes, but the whole point of this wingding was to meet new people. It would be bad form to spend the evening hiding from the very people she was supposed to meet. Instead of fleeing for the cool night air outside, Gwen stood there, alone in the crowd, looking and feeling tremendously uncomfortable. Gwen didn't see the tall, muscular guard who slowly approached her, looking furtively around, checking to see if anybody was watching. She didn't see him close his eyes and take a deep breath, as if psyching himself up for something. She didn't hear him mutter encouragement to himself. The guard opened his eyes and took two steps to his left so as to enter Gwen's field of view. Gwen saw the man approach, and at first she thought he was one of the typical city guards. Then she thought he was a guard who for some reason had a limp. Then she thought he was suffering a petit mal seizure. Finally, she realized he was just walking strangely. The men who were chosen to be the official guards were usually the very model of physical grace, but there was a jerky, forced uneasiness to this one's gait. The guard walked up to her. His smile was slightly goofy, and his eyes almost glowed with manic energy. The guard said, "Hi." Gwen said,
"Hello."
There was a pause while the guard thought, then he said, "My name is Ampix." Gwen squinted at the guard.
"Have we met before?"
Again, the guard calculated his response carefully before saying,
"Yes, you chose me to escort the visitors from your homeland. Thank you for that."
"Oh,"
Gwen said.
"How did you like my friends?"
"I did not like them,"
Ampix said enthusiastically.
"I found them distasteful."
"Oh,"
Gwen said.
"But I also realized that you made me endure them so that I, and only I, would see what it is you've been looking for in a servant all this time. No wonder you've rejected us. None of the men here were nearly weird, annoying, and uncoordinated enough to suit your particular tastes."
"And you are?"
Gwen asked, equal parts amused and horrified.
"No,"
Ampix said, his facade dropping for a moment to express his outrage at the very idea. Then his forced, goofy smile returned, and he said,
"But if I concentrate, I can feign being this way for you."
"That's impressive,"
Gwen said. Again, a moment's thought, then Ampix said,
"Thanks. Yeah, of course it would be a great shame to myself and my family if I acted like this in public. I'm only doing it now as a demonstration. Were you to choose me as your servant, I would put on this act for you only in our bedchamber."
"I see. And in public?"
"I would act like a proper man."
At some point, while nobody was looking, tables and chairs had appeared around the periphery of the room. They were probably brought in by servants, but nobody had noticed it happening, so it seemed like magic. Britt the Younger sat alone at one of the tables, trying to be invisible. Philip approached with two large, overtly decorative beverages. Philip said,
"I asked for whiskey, but all they had were piña coladas and mimosas, so I got one of each. Take whichever you like, and I'll have the other."
As he set the two drinks down, she said,
"Thank you, that's very sweet. But if you don't particularly want one over the other, and they didn't have what you asked for, why did you get them at all?"
Philip thought about that as he settled into his seat.
"Well, I didn't want to come back empty-handed. I consider just conjuring up two glasses of scotch, but it felt like to do that when there was an open bar would be, I don't know, disrespectful to my host somehow."
Britt the Younger said,
"You have a point. I suppose it would be."
She lifted her hand in front of her face and swiped her finger through the air. The tip of her finger glowed and left a vapor trail as she moved it from her right to her left, then from the bottom of her field of vision to the top. To the uninitiated, it probably seemed like she was casting some sort of spell, But to Philip, or anyone else who had ever used a modern computer interface, she was clearly making selections from a computer menu that only she could see. Finally, she jabbed her finger straight ahead twice, then traced a circle on the tabletop with her other hand. Two glasses of scotch appeared. She handed one to Philip, who took it happily.
"Excellent," he said. "Next round's on me."
Philip held the glass to his nose and lightly breathed in through his mouth, letting the fumes from the drink gently ascend into his nostrils.
"Oh, that's nice,"
he said before taking a sip. Britt swallowed her first sip, savored it for a moment, then said,
"I can make anything I want. I don't see any point in making crap."
Philip leaned back, looking first at the glass in his hand, then at the woman who gave it to him. He thought for a long moment, then said,
"I've been thinking I should give..."
Philip paused. Calling Britt the Elder Britt while talking to Britt the Younger seemed wrong somehow.
"My host, a thank you gift. Do you think a bottle of good scotch would be nice?"
"Yeah," Britt said. "That'd be great. I'd love it if you gave her a bottle of scotch. She hates the stuff."
Philip looked at her for a long moment, then said,
"I'm sorry. I have to admit, I'm having a lot of trouble getting my head around this."
Britt said,
"Yeah, join the club."
She took another sip. Philip looked into his drink again, but nothing he saw there made the situation easier to understand. He looked at the woman across from him again, enjoying her drink, and seemingly not much else. Finally, he thought,
"If we're going to talk, let's really talk."
"There are those who say that because nothing we do seems to change the future, it means that whatever we do now has to be what we did in the past. Essentially, they say that all of our decisions were made for us, and that all we can do is play our parts. They tell us that any effort we make to change the course of history, or our own destiny, is futile, and ultimately results in us becoming the very thing we struggled to keep from becoming."
Britt peered at him over the rim of her glass, pulled the drink down from her mouth without actually taking a drink, then asked Philip,
"That's what they say. What do you say?"
Philip smiled.
"Usually something loud and insulting. I am my own man. I make my own decisions. If the universe expects me to do anything different, it should prepare for a fight. I reject the idea that just because we can see the future, that we're doomed to create it. I say free will and imagination are deeply linked, and if you don't believe you have one, it just means that you lack the other."
Philip realized he was raising his voice. He took a deep breath.
"I get a little crazy when this topic comes up," Philip said. "I'm sorry. I'll stop now."
"No,"
Britt said.
"Please, go on."
The evening was wearing on, and Martin felt overwhelmed. He'd met too many people, made too much small talk, and found too little of it interesting. He was understimulated. He decided to retreat to the nearest balcony and get some air. When he got outside, he was surprised to find Gwen there, leaning forward on the railing with her back to the door. Martin walked up, quietly enough to not demand her attention, but loudly enough to avoid startling her. He leaned back onto the railing so that he and Gwen were next to one another, but facing opposite directions. She looked up at the city, a thousand flickering light boxes heaped all around them. He looked through the door into the party they were both avoiding. Martin asked,
"Who's that jerk who's been hanging around with you and Philip this afternoon?"
Gwen chuckled.
"Oh, he's just this guy I kind of almost had a thing with. He seems kind of needy."
Gwen turned to face Martin, but remained leaning casually on the rail.
"He's not so bad. He's smart and he's cute. He makes me smile, which counts for a lot. He just needs to learn to cool it sometimes."
Martin turned to look at her.
"Is that why you didn't want me to come here?"
Gwen said,
"For example, this would be a good time to cool it."
And turned her face back to the city, and away from Martin.
Gwen, seriously, if you don't want me around, I'll keep my distance. I'm not interested in forcing my company on someone who doesn't want it. I can avoid you for the next 2 weeks, if that's what you want.
Gwen asked,
Do you want to avoid me, Martin?
I want us both to be happy. Being around you makes me happy, so that's one of us. But if it makes you unhappy, well, that's a problem.
Having you around doesn't make me unhappy.
Good, Martin said. Not the highest praise I've ever heard. Wouldn't look good on a greeting card, but it's a start.
Gwen smiled.
Having you around makes me happy, Martin. Really, it's just we only knew each other for a couple of weeks, and then I had to move here. I thought I might invite you out to visit and see how things went, but then I got here, and... You've seen this place. Would you invite a guy here?
No, I would not, Martin admitted. I have to admit, I was happy to hear that you haven't claimed a servant yet. I had some ideas about what a female-led society would be like. None of them featured scantily clad beefcake and sexual service provider as a viable career path.
Gwen said,
Well, the sex with servants thing doesn't happen as often as the men would have you believe.
That's good to hear.
I mean, it does happen, Gwen said. Often, just not quite as often as they say. It's pretty bad, I agree, but don't judge the girls too harshly. If you think about it, it's the same arrangement as a wealthy old man and his trophy wife, only our way is more emotionally honest. Besides, a lot of the girls aren't romantically involved with their servants. They just picked a man they enjoy hanging around with. By the way, Gwen said, one of the guards is acting weird. I think he's trying to imitate you.
Oh, yeah, that would be Ampix. How's his impression?
Pretty insulting.
Martin laughed.
Good. If we play this right, we could have him wearing silver sequins by the end of the week.
Inside the hall, the party was beginning to wind down. The conversation was getting quiet, and the crowd was getting sparse. Philip had spent the better part of an hour telling Britt the Younger all of his theories that explained their apparent lack of impact on the future, while still allowing for free will. He had many possible explanations, but in the end she shook her head and said that none of them really applied to her.
See,
she explained.
I decided to come back here and see if there was an Atlantis, and about a second before I left, I thought, if there isn't one, I could just go back in time a little further and build Atlantis myself.
And what happened? Philip asked.
Exactly that, I guess. I got here and found the city pretty much as you see it, only there was this huge welcoming ceremony all set up waiting for me. There was music and cheering, and some woman who looks exactly like me walks up and hugs me and says that she's me, and there was no Atlantis before I came along. So I went back in time to build the city so it'd be here when I got here.
Philip's face twisted in concentration.
That just makes no sense.
Yeah, Britt said. I noticed.
But if she's you, and she got here and found no Atlantis, then you'd have found no Atlantis when you got here,
Britt said.
Yes, but she didn't get here and find no Atlantis. She found Atlantis as you see it now, and another woman who looked just like her and claimed to be her and have built Atlantis. Then, 50 years later, she went back in time, built Atlantis, and waited for me to show up.
Philip said,
So her memories do match your memories.
No,
Britt said.
Her memories match my present. Everything I do, she's done. Everything I think, she's thought. If I do something right, she gets the credit. If I do something wrong, she's the first to admit it, usually before or while I'm doing it. That's why none of your theories work in my case. You're explaining why we have no effect on the future. The future isn't my problem. She isn't in the future. She's here now, and as long as she's here, nothing I do affects the present.
Philip looked at her, sitting there, staring miserably at the empty glasses in front of her. She made it sound so futile.
I'm sure that's just the booze talking,
he thought. Then he thought,
no, it's her talking, but it's the booze thinking.
He wasn't far wrong. The alcohol in her system was affecting her thinking. Britt looked at Philip and thought,
He's cute, in a rumpled, worn-in kind of way. Older me wanted me to get to know him. I don't know why, but I tend to think I wouldn't like it if I did.
They made eye contact. They smiled. Then there was a hollow, popping noise, like someone opening a bottle of champagne. Philip looked alarmed, then in one movement stood up and swung his staff very fast overhand toward Britt's head. Britt instinctively cringed, shielding her head with both arms. Philip shouted something she didn't quite catch, then her world was nothing but noise and confusion. Gwen and Martin heard the crash from the balcony. They ran into the hall and found chaos. The lights came up. Martin could see that one of the large goddess statues that stood around the circumference of the room had fallen. There was a base, a pair of sculpted feet, and a nasty, ragged break at the thinnest part of the goddess's ankles. In front of that, there was a field of dust, shards of broken statue, crushed tables and chairs, and in the middle of it all stood Philip, his staff held far out in front of him like an axe stopped mid-swing. The debris on the floor was piled thick everywhere except for a perfect circle radiating outward from the tip of Philip's staff. Inside the circle, free from any damage, were Philip, the table he'd been sitting at, the chair that had been opposite him, and in the chair, directly under the tip of the staff, and as such at the center of the protected circle, Britt the Younger, looking confused. Philip said,
"Forige Shildo."
And for an instant, the outline of a dome of energy could be seen covering Philip and Britt before it disappeared. Philip practically ran around the table and took Britt by the hand, helping her up.
"Are you all right?"
he asked.
"Yes,"
she said.
"I think so."
Martin and Gwen slid to a stop after running across the hall.
"Are you two okay?"
Martin asked.
"Yes, we're both fine," Philip said. "Was anybody hurt?"
By this time, everyone who was still in attendance was standing around looking at the damage. Nobody seemed injured. It seemed that Philip and Britt the Younger were the only people who had been in the statue's landing zone. Gwen looked at the damaged statue's base and asked,
"What happened?"
From across the room, a woman's voice called out,
"I'll tell you exactly what happened."
Everyone turned to see Britt the Elder walking serenely through the crowd. She reached the debris field and said,
"Just as I remembered it, Philip was listening to me, complaining about the trivial things that seemed like problems to me at that age."
Britt the Elder walked to the table and looked at the three empty whiskey glasses in front of Britt the Younger's chair and shook her head. Britt the Younger's face turned bright red. Britt the Elder said,
"The hard stuff always did make me mopey. Anyway, dear Philip saw the statue break and start to fall, and did some very quick thinking in his attempt to save me from being hurt."
She bent at the knees, reached down, and picked up a broken piece of statue about a foot long. She stood up again and examined the chunk of debris. Philip said,
"It really wasn't much. It's just a simple shield spell."
"It was very sweet of you,"
Britt the Elder said,
"and also unnecessary. Much like you, we've manipulated the file to make ourselves impervious to damage."
To emphasize the point, Britt the Elder smashed the piece of debris she was holding over Britt the Younger's head. Britt the Younger flinched and yelped, but it was out of surprise, not pain. Britt the Younger said,
"You didn't know that, though, and it's the thought that counts."
Britt the Elder said,
"I agree."
She turned to Britt the Younger and said,
"And I think it's about time for you to go get some sleep."
12. Jimmy stood in the corner of the room, with one leg and both arms drawn up in front of him defensively.
"Get that thing away from me!"
he shouted. Agents Miller and Murphy were both up on their feet, gesticulating wildly.
"What's wrong with you?"
Agent Murphy cried. Agent Miller yelled,
"You idiot, get out of here before I smack you!"
They were in the conference room that Agent Miller and Agent Murphy had claimed as their command center at Seattle Police Headquarters, and they were all addressing an officer who was standing in the door holding a laptop computer.
"What?"
Officer Kyle asked.
"You said you needed a computer."
"I said we'd need a computer. I didn't say I wanted you to bring it to me,"
Jimmy said, still forcing himself into the corner.
"Get that thing out of here!"
Miller bellowed.
"What?"
Officer Kyle said, still not understanding.
This is a good computer.
Exactly,
Jimmy said.
And if you get it too close to me, I'll destroy the hard drive.
Officer Kyle asked Jimmy,
Are you threatening to damage Seattle PD property, old man?
He's not,
Miller said.
But I promise to damage a Seattle police officer if you don't get out of here.
Jimmy took on the most soothing tone he could muster while still actively cringing.
I'm not threatening to do anything, son. I just have a strong magnetic field, and I break any computer that gets too close to me for too long.
Kyle said,
Oh, that's nonsense. This computer works fine. I turned it on to make sure. Look, I'll show you.
He opened the computer and looked at the screen. Nothing happened. After a second, he hit the space bar a couple of times. Still, nothing happened. He pressed the power button. When nothing continued to happen, he said,
I'll be damned. It was just working a minute ago.
Officer Kyle timidly left the room. Agent Miller angrily watched him go. Agent Murphy and Jimmy reclaimed the seats they had hastily vacated when the officer had entered.
Let me get this straight, Agent Murphy said. You can't prove that what you're telling us is true without access to a computer. But if we get a computer anywhere near you, it stops working. You didn't think this out very well, did you, Jimmy?
I have a plan, Agent Murphy. I promise you I do. And the first step of the plan is to keep whatever computer we end up using far away from me.
Great, Miller said. Step one, you don't use a computer. Done. What's next?
Jimmy said,
I have designed a system that will let me direct one of you while you use a computer. There's a list of items we'll need in one of the notebooks you confiscated. I assume they are locked in the evidence vault? Sadly, it's a rather bulky apparatus, so we'll need a lot more room than we have, even in this conference room. Once we have that, I will direct the two of you to the file that will prove that I've been telling you the truth.
Miller shook his head.
So, after we move you to a larger space and buy you a bunch of stuff, then and only then you'll prove that the cock and bull story you've been feeding us is true. I don't like it. Not one bit.
I assure you that none of the items on the list are expensive or dangerous,
Jimmy explained. Agent Miller walked to Jimmy's end of the table. He towered imposingly over the older, seated man.
Look, he said. You know a bunch of things that nobody outside of our investigation is supposed to know, but that doesn't mean that Murph and I have to buy everything you say. You're asking us to believe that everything in the world, including us, is fake. Well, I want to see some proof before I even bother to look at your list, let alone buy you any of the stuff on it.
Jimmy said,
First of all, I'm not saying that anything is fake. I assure you, Agent Miller, you and your partner are real. You're just real parts of a computer program. That's all.
Agent Murphy said,
There, Miller. Doesn't that make you feel better?
Agent Miller didn't look like he felt any better. Jimmy continued,
As for proof, how much proof do you need? You've seen what my presence does to any electronics. I've noticed neither of you brings your cell phones anywhere near me anymore. You saw Martin Banks disappear right before your eyes when you had him in custody. How do you explain that? Come to think of it, how did you explain that? You can't have written the kid vanished on your official report. If you could, I doubt you'd be desperate enough to still be dealing with me, would you?
The door to the conference room swung open. Officer Kyle bounded in triumphantly.
Good news! I found you another laptop!
He held the computer up like a prize as he started across the room to give it to Jimmy. In an instant, Jimmy was back on his feet, pressing himself into the corner, trying to put as much space between himself and the computer as he could.
Don't bring it to me!
Jimmy cried.
I don't want it! Just keep it out there and let Agent Murphy look at it!
Officer Kyle stopped, confused.
You told me to get you a computer. I got you one. I'm sorry the last one didn't work, but this one does, I promise. Look!
Officer Kyle opened the laptop and instantly looked stricken.
I promise it was just working. I'll reboot it.
Agent Murphy stood and guided the young officer to the door by the shoulder, saying,
You do that. And if this computer doesn't work, you'll find us another. And when you do, just leave it outside the door and come get us.
Officer Kyle mumbled noncommittally as he left the room. Agent Murphy closed the door behind him, and the room returned to some sort of normalcy. Agent Murphy said,
"To answer your question about how we explained the Banks kid's disappearance, we just wrote that he escaped custody via unknown means. We don't really have to come up with an explanation until we catch and prosecute him."
Jimmy said,
"Yeah, I'm sure your supervisors will find that real satisfying. You can't explain what Martin did, how it was illegal, or how he got away from you."
"And you can?"
Agent Murphy asked.
"And I will,"
Jimmy answered.
"But for what it's worth, I don't believe you're going to end up prosecuting Martin, or anybody else. I don't think any of us have broken any laws."
"He deposited tens of thousands of dollars into his personal bank account without doing anything to earn it, and without being given it by anyone. How can he possibly do that in any way that's legal?"
"The way he did it is legal, as I've told you before, because nobody's made it illegal yet. He didn't steal it from anybody. Nobody was deprived by his actions. He didn't take the money from anyone. He created it himself."
Agent Miller smirked.
"Sounds like counterfeiting to me."
The door blasted open again, and Officer Kyle bolted in, holding the laptop. It was open, and the screen was showing a desktop cluttered with icons. He held it facing away from himself so as to show the men in the room.
"Look, see, I told you it worked!"
Jimmy didn't bother to get up this time. He just looked at Officer Kyle, pointed at the computer, and made a twirling motion with his index finger. The officer turned the computer around, looked at the screen, and yelled,
"Damn!"
13. The first full day of the summit got off to a good start. The same hall that hosted the reception had been converted overnight to house the summit. This struck Martin as odd, but Gwen would later point out that Britt had worked at a large resort hotel and had designed this room as a sort of convention center. Tables large enough for two adults to sit comfortably were arranged in neat rows. Each table had a place card naming two representatives and the time traveler communities from which they came. Also, the statue of a toga-clad Harriet Tubman that had caused all of the commotion the night before had already been replaced. Philip asked one of the guards why the statue had fallen and was told,
"Britt the Elder seems to know what's going on."
Which Philip agreed was true, but pointed out was not an answer. All of the delegates found their way to their assigned seats. The tables were arranged alphabetically, chronologically, so if there were two teams from a given place, whichever team was from an earlier point in history came first. This meant that the table next to Martin and Phillips was assigned to Gilbert and Sid, the two dandies from 19th century London who'd been so hostile the night before. The Atlantis delegation was last to arrive. Both of the Brits, Ida, the president, and several other women, Gwen among them, all arrived together. Britt the younger and Ida took their places as delegates. At the head of the room, a dais held a podium where Britt the elder took her assigned place as the speaker. The rest of the team from Atlantis took seats in the observers' areas set along both sides of the hall. The proceedings began with a brief overview of the schedule and a list of the topics to be discussed during the summit. It was all perfectly straightforward. The first item of business was the adoption of a formal name for the time-traveling, magic-using peoples being governed by the summit. Britt the Elder mentioned offhand that she favored the term time-travelers, and that until the formal vote, that was the term she would use. Not that it mattered, since she also mentioned that she remembered that this was the term the group would vote to use anyway. Other than that, most of the agenda dealt with prevention of abuse by time travelers of the indigenous peoples and other time travelers. The only part that confused those listening was when Britt the Elder announced,
"Sessions will begin promptly at 9 o'clock each morning, and will run until 5 each evening, except for next Sunday, which we'll have off, and today's session, which will end abruptly this afternoon after something unexpected happens."
The morning session proceeded past Martin like a slow-motion blur. It was a room full of earnest people having serious conversations about topics of great importance and very little interest. At one point, Philip caught Martin on the verge of nodding off. Philip prodded Martin with his elbow. Martin sat up and tried to look interested, but he grumbled while he did it.
"What's wrong with you?" Philip asked.
Sorry. Watching parliamentary procedure always makes me bored and angry. I think it has to do with the Star Wars prequels.
Philip furrowed his brow.
Wait a minute. They made prequels to Star Wars?
Martin winced. He remembered that he, Tyler, Gary, and Jeff had all sworn never to tell Philip about the Star Wars prequels.
There are some things about the future that he's better off not knowing, Jeff had argued.
Like all events designed to help people meet and better understand each other, most of the real progress took place during breaks. The highlight of the day was during the lunch break, when someone pointed out that Philip, a purebred Englishman, was eating a burrito, while one of the Aztec delegates had magicked up an order of authentic London fish and chips. After lunch, there was another monotonous barrage of absolutely vital discussions. Martin managed to stay awake, but just barely. During the afternoon break, he made his way out to the corridor. He produced a large cup of coffee from his hat and was just about to take a sip when he saw Gwen. He made a beeline for her, mostly because he loved spending time with her, but also because he knew that she was from a time near his and would understand his Star Wars prequel reference, which had sailed right over Philip's head.
"Hey, Gwen, how's it going?" he asked.
"Good, Martin," she replied. "How are you today?"
"Fine, I'm fine. I gotta say, though, this meeting, with all of these motions being raised and seconded, I feel like I'm in one of the Star Wars prequels."
"I know,"
Gwen enthused. She proceeded to go on at length about how much she loved the Star Wars prequels, and how particularly the part set in the Galactic Senate gave all of the events much more of a sense of gravitas. Martin drank his coffee as quickly as he could and tried to pretend the conversation wasn't happening. Finally, mercifully, a bell rang, announcing that the break would end in 1 minute. As Martin returned to his seat, he noticed that Philip had apparently spent the break sitting in the president's empty seat, talking to Britt the Younger. Philip walked back to his own seat, smiling. Britt remained at hers, smiling as well. Philip was nearly to the table when the hall resounded with a dull pop. Philip looked stricken. Martin saw Philip make an involuntary grasping motion with his right hand, his usual staff hand. Martin also saw that Philip's staff was still on the table next to where Martin sat. Philip spun around just in time to see Britt the Younger, still in her seat, looking upward at another of the toga-draped goddess statues, which, like the one the night before, was falling directly on top of her. Martin yelled, "Philip!" He threw Philip's staff at him, but it was far too late. The statue hit the floor with astonishing force. A deafening crash reverberated throughout the hall. People dove for cover as chunks of statue flew through the air. Once the noise subsided, the delegates turned to look at the damage. They saw the ruined base of the statue and a great deal of rubble. Philip was still standing exactly where he had been when the statue first started to fall, and in the center of all the rubble, there was Britt the Younger, sitting on the floor amongst the splintered kindling that used to be her chair and table. She looked at the ruins around her and at the empty space where the statue used to stand, and she said,
"Seriously?"
The head of the statue rolled noisily to a stop. Martin looked at it, grimaced, and said,
"Ugh, is that Ayn Rand?"
The sound of a gavel echoed through the hall. All eyes turned to the podium, and Britt the Elder, who was rapping her gavel for order.
"As I stated this morning, something unexpected has occurred. I move that we adjourn for the day. Seconded?"
Britt the Younger seconded the motion. 14. After the delegates had mostly cleared out, Gwen came back to the main hall. She wanted a look at the statue's base. Truth be told, she had wanted a good look at the base of the first statue that fell the night before and had gotten up early to sneak into the hall to snoop around a bit. but the statue had been repaired during the night. In the convention center, she saw servants cleaning up rubble, and Martin, leaning on his staff, looking at the podium, deep in thought. Martin turned as Gwen approached. He nodded, smiled, then turned his attention back to the podium. It was pristine and undamaged from the floor up to the point where the ankles and gown tapered to their narrowest points. There, the material was sheared smoothly at an angle, as if cut with a saw, then sanded to remove any imperfections.
"How often do those stupid statues break at the ankles and fall over?"
Martin asked.
"Never,"
Gwen answered.
"The entire time I've been here, it's never happened, and none of the other sorceresses can remember it ever happening either."
"Well," Martin said,
"I'd say that's suspicious, but I think you're way ahead of me on that."
"Yeah,"
Gwen said.
"It's not very subtle, is it? I mean, at least last night the statue was posed with its legs together, so the statue only had to break at one point. This one had its legs apart, so the statue had to break cleanly in two places at the same time."
"I know," Martin said. "And even if the statues did fall over twice in 2 days, the fact that they both fell on the same person is just a dead giveaway.
How is Britt, by the way?"
Gwen said,
"Shaken up. It didn't hurt her at all physically, but that kind of thing still takes its toll on your nerves."
"Yeah, I know.
Gwen, how well do you know Britt?"
"She's my best friend."
Martin thought a second, then asked,
"Which one?"
Gwen answered,
"Both of them. They're the same person. You get that, don't you, Martin? I mean, I thought I'd explain that."
Martin held up a hand in surrender.
Yeah, I know. It's just weird. I know they're the same person, and they look exactly alike, but they act so differently. And besides, they don't seem to get along that well."
"Yeah,"
Gwen sighed.
"There's some tension there. They're just very different people."
Martin let this pass. He got up close to the pedestal, examining one of the broken ankles in more detail.
"What is this made of? Not more diamond, is it?"
"No, diamond is good for some things, but not as good for others. Besides, it'd be pretty boring if everything were made of diamond."
"I suppose this is what passes for boredom when you're a time-traveling wizard," Martin thought.
Gwen continued.
"Diamond is used for the large-scale structural pieces, but most smaller-scale construction and decorative work is actually a toughened glass."
"Really?"
Martin asked.
"Like Pyrex?"
Gwen nodded.
"Well, what do you know? Philip was right."
Gwen looked around the room.
"Hey, where is Philip?"
"Dunno," Martin said, still looking at the shorn ankles of the statue. "He hung around for a few minutes after the crash, then said he had something he needed to do and took off."
Britt the Younger was curled up in her favorite chair, looking miserable when the doorbell rang. The second time it rang, she wondered why her servant hadn't answered it. The third time it rang, she remembered that her servant had gone out to get her dinner. The fourth time it rang, she realized that it wasn't reasonable to expect whoever was ringing to wait for her servant to return and answer the door. The fifth time it rang, she realized that whoever it was doing the ringing was probably tenacious enough to wait for her servant, but she'd have to listen to this ringing the whole time. She hoisted herself up from her chair and walked to the door, slowly enough that ring number 6 occurred while she was in transit. She looked through the peephole and was delighted by who she saw. Philip said,
"Britt, we need to talk. I think someone's trying to kill you."
"Of course they are. Come in."
Philip entered Britt's home and immediately had to stop to take it in. He had been in Atlantis less than a day, and while he was accustomed to everything being beautiful, Britt's living room still came as a shock. Like his and Martin's quarters, one entire wall was the curved, transparent outer wall of the city, providing a panoramic view of the ocean. Britt's home was much lower in the dish than Philip's, so the wall was raked at a much steeper angle, and the ocean outside was a much darker blue. Britt's floor was a single slab of pristine white perfection, with a subtle etched grid pattern to help give a sense of scale. Her furniture was sleek and modern, yet comfortable-looking.
It was the kind of room Philip had seen pictures of in magazines and thought, nice, but no real human being could possibly live like that. It was the kind of room he had tried to create in his attic back home, but hadn't had the taste to pull off. Philip said, nice place. Britt said,
eh,
then curled back up in her favorite chair, which looked to Philip like a matched set of comfy cushions supported by just enough milky glass to maintain structural integrity. Philip sat in the identical chair opposite her, leaned in for emphasis, and said,
Britt, I'm serious. I think someone's trying to kill you.
Britt replied,
yeah, I know.
Philip still wasn't sure his words were getting through to her.
I don't believe the statue was an accident.
I know it wasn't, Philip. Obviously, it wasn't even the first attempt.
Philip nodded.
Yes, the statue last night.
Philip leaned back in his chair and took a moment to try to figure out what was going on. After a moment, he came to the conclusion that what was going on was that he didn't know what was going on, and that anything beyond that was uncertain.
You don't seem very worried, he said.
I'm not.
Someone's trying to kill you, Britt.
Yes, but they're failing at it, and they're going to keep failing.
How can you be sure?
Philip asked.
Because Britt the Elder is here. She makes me miserable, but one bright side to her existence is that as long as she's around, I know I'll live long enough to be her someday.
Philip considered this.
I guess that is a pretty good bright side.
Yeah,
Britt agreed.
It'd be even brighter if I liked her, or wanted to be her, but there it is. Even when your future is good, it's not necessarily the one you want. Anyway, as long as I know that whoever is trying to kill me will never succeed, then their constant attempts are just an inconvenience.
That's one heck of an inconvenience,
Philip said.
Eh, I don't know,
Britt said.
It's always over fast, and they come to wherever I am. Really, as attempted murderers go, I think I'm getting pretty good service.
Philip was about to comment on this when the door opened. Britt's servant walked in, carrying a steaming crock of some fantastic-smelling liquid. Unlike all of the other servants Philip had seen, Britt's servant was average height, and while thin and in good condition, he was not so muscular as to be bulky. He was dressed in the same ridiculous mesh top and kilt as all servants, but he somehow wore it with more dignity than the others. As he entered, the servant said,
I'm back, and I got that soup you like. The shop was about to close, so I had to beg a bit, but I told them it was for you, and there's no problem.
The servant saw Philip.
Oh, I didn't know you were going to have company for dinner. I'm glad I got extra soup.
Britt stood and said,
Ah, I should introduce you. This is my servant, Nicholas.
The servant bowed slightly, still smiling, and said,
Please call me Nick. You must be Philip.
Philip stood up and returned the bow.
It's good to meet you, Nick.
Nick looked Philip in the eye, kept his smile turned up to maximum, and said,
It's good to meet you, Philip. I've heard a lot about you.
Philip said,
I hope you heard good things.
Nick held the smile and the eye contact just long enough to make Philip uncomfortable, then said,
I know you do.
Nick and Britt shared a small laugh, which Philip joined in an attempt to be pleasant. Nick winked at Philip so quickly that he wasn't really sure he'd seen it. Then Nick started walking toward the door at the side of the room.
You two get comfortable,
he said.
I'll pour this soup into a couple of bowls for you and be right back.
Actually,
Britt said, stopping Nick in his tracks.
I've changed my mind. If you could please keep the soup warm for a little while, I think I need to get out of the house and clear my head a bit.
Nick bowed again, said that this would not be a problem, and gave Philip another smile. Philip wasn't sure if Nick was smiling at him or smiling with him. Philip said,
I suppose I should be getting back.
Britt said,
You could do that, or you could come with me. I wouldn't mind the company.
Philip remembered the look Nick had given him and thought,
Okay, I guess he was smiling with me.
Philip had expected getting out of the house to entail walking out the door, but instead, Britt reached down to the floor next to her chair and brought up what appeared to be a small, rectangular sheet of glass. She held it with both hands, and the flat surface of the glass came alive with printed shapes and symbols. Philip leaned in closer to get a better look. Britt tilted the sheet of glass so that Philip could see it better. The buttons were all clearly marked. Philip only had time to glance, but he could see that there were controls for the heat and lighting in the various rooms in Britt's home. Various other buttons did other things that Philip was sure he could figure out if he had the time. He had seen some gadgets from after his time, but nothing like this. There was literally no place for any electronics that he could see. It looked for all the world like a simple sheet of glass, except that animated symbols and text were flowing smoothly over its surface.
"What year are you from?"
Philip asked, amazed.
"I'm from 1996,
Britt answered, more than a little puzzled by the tone of the question. She looked at Philip, followed his gaze to the tablet in her hands, then laughed.
"This isn't from the future. It's just a sheet of glass with the edges sanded. Our version of what you call the shell can project touch controls onto any surface, or into thin air. Usually the person using the controls is the only one who can see them, but I made this up so there'd be visible controls for Nick to use."
Britt pressed a button in the corner of the tablet, then pointed out the curved, wall-sized window into the ocean beyond. As if called into being by the act of her pointing, a glowing sphere appeared, dimly at first, then quite brightly, before dimming again to be barely visible. Britt lowered the sheet of glass and extended a hand for Philip to take.
"Our ride is here,"
she said. Philip reached for his staff, which he'd placed on the ground next to his chair.
"You won't need that,"
Britt said.
"Besides, it won't fit."
Philip left his staff on the floor and took Britt's hand. She tapped the corner of her control panel with her thumb, and the next instant she and Philip were looking in at the living room from outside the window. Philip looked around the interior of the sphere. At first it seemed to Philip that he was simply floating at a fixed point under the sea, but he immediately realized that he was standing upright, perfectly dry, and breathing normally. They were inside the sphere that he had seen Britt conjure up just a moment before. It was perfectly transparent, with a flat, clear floor and two clear chairs. She sat in one. He took the other. She pulled her legs up underneath her with her control panel on her lap. Philip couldn't easily read it from where he was, but he could tell that she was scrolling through various options. Philip asked,
"Do you just conjure one of these things up whenever you want?"
"I could do it that way. Really, it'd be just as easy. But I keep this one around all the time. It just hovers outside my window until I need it. I like knowing that I have a vehicle, and that it's there when I need it."
Philip considered telling her about his Fiero, but decided against it.
"Not yet, at least."
Britt turned to Philip and said,
"We have all of the oceans to choose from. That's 2/3 of the Earth's surface. Anything you want to see?"
"Surprise me."
Britt looked at him thoughtfully for a moment, then scrolled through her list of options and selected one. Instantly, the world got much brighter. The deep blue that had surrounded them was replaced with a lighter shade that gave way to an undulating plain of silver above them and an explosion of colors beneath. Philip had watched enough nature programs to know that he was looking at a reef. Bizarre organic shapes in colors Philip had never imagined spread out beneath them, fading into the murky blue distance. As Britt piloted their craft between the silver boundary above and the neon obstacles below, a school of fish, swimming in tight formation, played chicken with their craft. The fish swam straight ahead, directly into Britt and Philip's path, then parted silently, enveloping them for a moment before reforming behind them, as if nothing had been in their way to begin with. A strange shadow fell over Philip. He looked up and saw that a manta ray was swimming overhead, briefly eclipsing the sun. Philip said,
"I just can't get over it, Britt."
Britt said,
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. This submarine, it's amazing. There are no seams, no moving parts. It's so elegant. And the fact that I know exactly how it works just makes it more impressive. I mean, it's all the same basic things we've all been doing all along. Replicating, materializing, levitating, and moving through time and space. But it just never occurred to us to put it all together like this."
"I'm glad you approve."
I,
Philip stammered.
I once made a car indestructible and gave it unlimited fuel. I thought that was pretty clever. I see now that was so needlessly complex. I could have just made it move forward without the engine. It would have been silent, which would be a bit weird, but I'd have thought of some way around that.
That's an easy fix, Britt said. It's not hard to alter something's sound and light signatures. This bubble is completely silent and invisible.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. We could hover over Disneyland watching kids ride the teacups for an hour and nobody would see us.
That would be great for hopping around time, checking out historic events, Philip said.
Yeah, Britt agreed. I considered that, but then I realized that most of history is made up of things I'm actually pretty happy that I wasn't there to see.
Good point. I once went to the Kennedy assassination. I wanted to see who that shadowy figure on the grassy knoll was.
Britt's eyes widened.
You actually went to the grassy knoll?
Philip nodded.
Who was there?
Britt asked. Philip gritted his teeth.
Nobody, until I got there. Luckily, not many people saw me. I managed to stay in the shadows.
They continued their tour of the reef in silence for a moment. Then Philip continued.
Anyway, like I was saying, it just never occurred to me to assemble these kinds of complex constructions, like this sub, or the elevator platforms, or, frankly, Atlantis itself. I'm just blown away by it all, and Gwen tells me it was all your idea.
Yep, Britt said. My idea.
Philip said,
well done.
Without turning to face him, Britt said,
I'll pass your compliment along to Britt the Elder.
Philip cursed himself. Here he was trying to pay her a compliment, and he had said the exact wrong thing. He started to apologize, but Britt cut him off.
No, Philip, I'm sorry. You were just being nice. I handled that gracelessly. I did come up with the ideas, laying down materials an atom at a time, using the objects made that way to build complex structures and devices, building Atlantis if it didn't already exist. Heck, going to Atlantis in the first place. They were all my ideas. The whole reason I wanted to go to Atlantis was that I had all these things I wanted to try. And it's hard to do that when you're living with your parents in Racine, Wisconsin.
What did you do for a living in Racine?
Philip asked.
I was a tour guide at the Johnson Wax Building. That Frank Lloyd Wright really knew how to design a building. Except for the roofs. They always leak. Seems like a funny thing for the world's greatest architect to be bad at. Roofs. It's kind of the primary reason to make a building in the first place, wouldn't you say? To keep the rain out?
Philip agreed.
Anyway, Britt continued, I had all these crazy ideas I couldn't wait to try, no place to try them, so I go back in time to Atlantis, and when I get there, Britt the Elder is waiting for me with the good news that she already tried my ideas, and they all worked. She'd use them to build the city, just like I wanted to, and all of the people who live there are very grateful to her.
I can see why you'd resent that. Just trying to be positive, though, the whole reason she's here is because you go back in time at some point in the future and become her. So you will get to build the city, and you do get to try all of your ideas, and eventually you will get the credit.
Britt turned, looked at Philip, and said,
Please, Philip, don't be so positive. It's not becoming for people like us.
Which got a small laugh out of Philip. She continued,
And when I do go back and build, I won't really be designing and building. I'll be copying what was here when I got here. I'll be copying from her.
But if she's you...
Then who am I copying? Who designed Atlantis in the first place? I don't know, but I do know that it wasn't me, and really, that's all I care about right now.
Philip started to say something, but Britt put a finger across his lips to silence him. She smiled, but with firmness in her tone, she said,
And frankly, I'm talking about someone I can't stand. If the best thing you can think of to cheer me up is to tell me that I'll be just like her someday, I'd suggest that you probably shouldn't bother.
Philip smiled and nodded. Britt took her finger away. They rode in silence as strange, colorful sea creatures swam past. Britt piloted the bubble over a tall stand of coral, and before them a vista of brightly colored shapes stretched on as far as they could see. Fritz said,
"So, Philip, you haven't had much to say about the reef. What do you think?"
"It's very nice," Philip said. He looked around a bit, then added, "Pretty."
Britt looked at him, a smile slowly growing on her face. She bit her lip, then turned her attention to the control panel